was a wave function. And this is a question that's come up several times already during the conference. The short answer is, the wave function is a mathematical object. It's a function that we use in quantum mechanics to represent the quantum state of a system. It takes as its, it has a number of arguments equal to the number of degrees of freedom of the system you're studying. So if the system we're studying is n particles, then there's 3n arguments to the wave function. What I want to say, though, is that that's not necessarily the most perspicuous way of representing the quantum state. And it can be a bit misleading to think of quantum states in terms of wave functions, in part because there's a tendency to for that kind of representation to make a wave function look a little bit too familiar, too much like something we're familiar with, like in classical physics. And one thing I would like to point out is that we don't think of quantum mechanics as a fundamental theory. Quantum mechanics is inherently a non-relativistic theory applicable to systems of a fixed, finite number of degrees of freedom. And, of course, that's what you get when you take your first quantum theory course. But when you're on your second and third quantum theory course, they say, hold it, wait, that's not adequate. Particularly when you go to a relativistic domain, there's a number of considerations to the effect that leads you to the conclusion, no, actually, we can't confine ourselves to a fixed, finite number of degrees of freedom. We need a theory of systems with at least a potentially infinite number of degrees of freedom to be properly relativistic. And the theory that you get out of that is what's called quantum field theory. And the way I would parse it is, that's the quantum theory of systems that you get when you quantize the classical system of fields. So you shouldn't think that quantum field theory means that it's a theory whose subject matter is necessarily quantum fields. What the subject matter ought to be, what the ontology ought to be, is well, not clear at best. So I'm going to talk a bit about quantum field theory and talk about how you get wave functions, quantum mechanical wave functions, as a sort of low-energy, non-relativistic approximation to things in the theory, because I think that that's actually helps us to think about what these wave functions are. So let's start with a bit of history. The origin of these wave functions comes from the de Broglie pilot wave theory, which was later, 25 years later, revived by Bohm. So when people were talking about the Bohm theory, same theory as the de Broglie pilot wave theory. De Broglie had the idea that classical mechanics had to be modified. You've got point particles moving around, but they wouldn't always obey the Newtonian equations of motion. There would be associated with them a wave which would influence their motion. He called it the pilot wave or the guiding wave. He said some things about it, but it was Schrödinger who came up with a wave equation for these waves. And then he said, okay, let's have a theory with just the waves in it. And we move the particles. Producing a theory that was difficult to interpret as a physical theory about things in the world around us. But the original idea was, fairly conservative, that you've got these particles, the wave function is thought of as a field on physical space, analogous to electromagnetic fields. In fact, the idea de Broglie had is that you would have wave functions for photons, and there the wave would be the electromagnetic field guiding the photon along. Now there's a hitch in that interpretation of these wave functions as things analogous to classical fields. And the hitch is that when you start coming up with the theory for more than one particle, as Tim emphasized, the wave function is a function not on ordinary space, but on a 3n-dimensional configuration space. And that's led a lot of people to say, okay, this isn't something so familiar. You know, this isn't like, like familiar classical fields that we're used to. This is something new. This is something that exists only in quantum mechanics. But suppose you were stubborn. Suppose you insisted that, damn it, no, it is a field. Plainly. So as you said, wave functions are plainly fields. And fields, as we all know, are intrinsic properties of the points which they're associated with. But they're not associated with points in ordinary space. They're associated with points in configuration space. Right. So if you insisted they are indeed fields, you'd end up saying things like this. The space we live in, the space in which any realistic understanding of quantum mechanics is necessarily going to depict the history of the world as playing itself out, is configuration space. And whatever impression we have to the contrary, whatever impression we have, say, of living in a three-dimensional space or in a four-dimensional space-time is somehow flatly illusory. And David Albert isn't the only person who says things like this. I like this. I have this quote because I like the metaphor. We can think of the manifest world, the world of macroscopic objects and their motions, as shadows cast by the quantum state and the world particle as they evolve in configuration space. If Bohm's theory or any other version of quantum mechanics that construes the wave function realistically is correct, then that space is configuration space. Now, I think in both these quotes, both David and Barry primarily have the Bohm theory in the back of their mind. But notice that they both say that this conclusion is going to be true of any theory, any version of quantum mechanics that construes the wave function realistically. And the reason I mentioned that is that there are different avenues of interpretation of quantum mechanics. The Bohmian line of interpretation has the wave function as in some sense part of its ontology, but that's not everything. You know, there's these point particles moving around. There are, however, lines of interpretation that adopt a quantum state monist interpretation. So the Everettian are many worlds. Everything there is in the world is supposed to be whatever is represented by the quantum state. The motivation for dynamical collapse theories, which modify laws of motion for the wave function, was originally to make sense of a quantum state monist interpretation without going to something like a many worlds. Now, if you think of the wave function in this way of a function on a high dimensional space, and then you remove those point particles and you try to think of a quantum state monist ontology, then it seems like you're faced with actually serious problems because, Tim puts this very well, if you haven't got particles, to have configurations, there's not, these points in configuration space aren't configurations of anything. They're not configurations of, point particles in space. And it looks like your quantum state monism is going to be a theory that somehow comes unstuck from ordinary space-time, and you'll have trouble making sense of a world of things in ordinary space-time. So here's Tim. Any theory whose physical ontology is a complete wave function monism automatically inherits a severe interpretational problem. If all there is the wave function, an extremely high-dimensional object evolving in some specified way, how does that account for the low-dimensional world of localized objects that we start out believing in, whose apparent behavior constitutes the explanandum of physics in the first place? Now, what I want to argue is, if you look at how wave functions emerge as a sort of low, if you look at how quantum mechanics emerges as a sort of a non-relativistic low-energy approximation to a quantum field theory, and if you look at how you get wave functions out of such a theory, then there are going to be problems with ontology. You're going to have to understand how to think of quantum, the theory as a theory about a world of objects. But you're not going to be tempted to think that the default is this huge high-dimensional space where there's any problem with the relation of the theory to space-time. And I'll explain that as I go. So, all right. So I want to argue, first of all, on proper understanding of the wave function, first of all, there's no reason to think of configuration space as more fundamental than ordinary space-time, but what we're going to do is we're going to construct for certain kinds of states in a sort of approximate way configuration space from a theory defined on ordinary space-time. On a quantum state monist ontology, there's no problem with the relation of quantum states to ordinary space-time. And even for a single particle wave function, the value, there's an important disanalogy between wave functions and fields. As Tim pointed out, for a single particle wave function, there's an isomorphism between the configuration space and ordinary space. But we usually think of fields as attributing local properties, local variables, attributing the field value at a point is a local property of the point of the space it's defined on. And what I want to say is wave functions aren't like that, even in the single particle case. The value of the even a single particle wave function at a point is a fact about the global state. Okay. And if I have time, I don't know if I'll get to this last part, I'll make some remarks about thinking the wave function in this way sheds light on some of Einstein's earlier comments about quantum mechanics in 1927. It helps us see them as precursors to the later arguments, EPR type arguments. Okay. So, my guiding or motivating principle is, well, quantum mechanics is not fundamental. We want to nevertheless say something about the ontology of the world according to quantum mechanics, but we should do it with some caution. We should bear in mind it's not a fundamental theory, but and anything we say should be compatible with regarding that theory, not as fundamental but an approximation to some deeper theory. In the case of quantum mechanics, we know that's true. That it's not fundamental. And we have a more fundamental theory in quantum field theories. But I would say that that's, don't think that I'm saying, well, I'm treating quantum field theory as if it's fundamental. There again, we know that that's true. We have good reason to believe that it breaks down at some point. But we should, I think always bear in mind when we're doing metaphysics of physics that what we've got is almost certainly not a fundamental theory. And that doesn't mean that you might say, wait, we can't do metaphysics. Well, classical mechanics is telling us something about the world, and it's and classical objects are are real even if they're not fundamental, even if their structure is in something that looks non-classical at a deeper level. Okay. All right. And actually, ignore that last one. Okay. Another guiding principle is, and this is something that's come up in discussions, is I don't know any way of understanding what the way of the world is except letting physical theory be my guide. And so we should look at our physical theories and try to ask what they're telling us about the world and resist the temptation to simply ask, well, does this fit into some pre-existing framework that Aristotle or David Lewis or someone came up with. And if the conclusions are that it seems to be telling us that there are aspects of the world, there are things in the world that are quite unlike anything we'd ever thought of before the advent of quantum mechanics, then okay. And this isn't peculiar to quantum mechanics. I think that if you actually look at the history of science, there are many episodes where you can say, okay, people are running up against phenomena that they don't quite have the concepts to deal with, and they're coming up with new concepts. So this isn't something that started in the 20th century. Okay, so terminology, just so we agreed, I want to say that a physical quantity is intrinsic to a space-time region if the fact that it has the value it has carries no implications about states of affairs outside the region. So, for example, you know, we usually think of,
the color of this table would be,
I don't have to tell anybody in the outside room to talk meaningfully about the color of the table. However, the distance I am from Toronto is not, intrinsic property of anything in the room. Like it's an explicit reference to something outside the room. Local Biable is something to be regarded as an intrinsic property of some bounded region of space-time, which we want to take those as small, and I'll say it's local to that region. So asking whether something local Biable is relativized to what region you're talking about. A description of the world, description of the state of the world, we'll say, is separable if it supervenes on assignments of local vehicles to arbitrarily small region of space. So all you have to say is, here's this small region of space time, what are all the local vehicles here? Here's this region of space time, here's what are all the local vehicles here? And do that for everything. If once you're done with that, you've said everything there is about the world, you've got a separable theory or separable state description, otherwise it's non-separable. The reason I'm bringing that up is this is something that that's been mentioned several times at this conference. If you take quantum states as, in some sense, states of the world, and you interpret them realistically, then, at least on the most straightforward construal of quantum theory, it's non-separable. And the reason I say at least on the most straightforward construal of quantum theory is that this move to a high-dimensional space that's made by David Atwood and Barry Lower is, and if you look at those papers, it's explicitly a move to rescue separability from the threat of quantum non-separability. You can't get a separable state description in our ordinary three-dimensional space-time. Let's go bigger. Okay. All right. Barbara used this phrase, quantum state monism, the view is all there is to the world is whatever is represented by the quantum state, however you want to think of the quantum state. Okay. There's a phrase that's become very common in the literature, which is wave function realism. And this is from Alyssa and I's chapter in the book called The Wave Function. And I think she's capturing what's become standard terminology. The view that the wave function is a fundamental object in a real physical field on configuration space is today referred to as wave function realism. I would prefer to avoid that terminology because, the position I'm going to be taking in this talk is that wave functions the quantum state is real. Wave functions qua representation of the vehicle we use to represent the quantum state represents something real. So in that sense, I'm a wave function realist. But I'm not going to treat the wave function as a fundamental object. And so I'm going to agree that the wave function represents something real. I'm not going to agree that it's fundamental. And I'm not going to agree that it's a field on configuration space. So, the term wave function realism should be reserved for the first of those and not the three. But really, she's right. That's how the phrase tends to get used. Okay. All right. Okay. I've been talking about quantum field theories. There's going to be some slides with math on them. And, you know, they're going to be there for those who like that sort of thing. But I'm going to do my best to convey the gist of what I'm saying to those who aren't into the math. So when you set up a quantum field theory, you start with some space-time manifold. Typically, it's typically the motivation for moving from quantum mechanics to a quantum field theory is in part because there's real problems with making quantum mechanics relativistic. So it's typically done in Minkowski space context of special relativity. There are textbooks that, as a warm-up, start quantum field theory on Galilean space-time, and I actually think that's pedagogically a good way to do it. So you can do non-relativistic quantum field theory. You can also do it on curved space-times. It's harder, but you can do it. Pretty much everything I'm going to have to say is going to be in the context of Minkowski space-time. And what you do is, in quantum mechanics, okay, this is already a bit mathy, but when you make a quantum theory, what you typically do is you write down the classical theory, and you've got configuration variables and momentum variables, and then you put hats on them, and you say, okay, now these are operators on some mathematical space, Hilbert space, and the corresponding thing in quantum field theory is you have field operators which are associated with points in space and time. So that x denotes a space and time. So the whole mess of these. Every point in space time you're going to have one, and then you're going to have equations relating them. And out of those, you can construct other operators. They'll be associated with regions of space-time. So, I can multiply them and get another operator defined at that point. I can sort of smear them out over finite regions or larger regions that have an operator associated with regions of space-time. And actually, those are the ones who are actually genuinely operators. The cognoscenti in the room will recognize that those are what I'm calling field operators or actually operator value distributions. We construct algebraic fields of operators using space-time, and those are going to be the quantum analogs of various quantities associated with the fields, like energy densities, charge densities, or things like that. And then what a quantum state is just a function assigning numbers to those operators. That's what it is mathematically. Now, the question is, how do we interpret that function? Well, the standard answer is what those numbers are when they're, for operators corresponding to observables, those are real numbers, and those are interpreted in the standard answer is, in operational terms, those are expectation values. If I do an experiment, that I might get various values with certain probabilities, and that value is the expectation values, or weighted average of the various possible outcomes weighted by the probabilities. On a quantum state monist ontology, we're going to want to read that in a much thicker sense and say something like, when I've got a state where a certain quantity, say energy density or charge density, by the way, charge density, you remember those pictures of orbitals that Tim had up yesterday, you can take those as pictures of charge densities for certain quantum states. So for certain cases where you want to say, if you want to be a quantum state monist, you say, well, we take those energy densities, charge densities more seriously as something that's there even when we're not measuring it. And the problem is that even at a certain big point, there's going to be sort of some spread in the values. And if you want to be a quantum state monist, you're going to have to, you know, learn to live with that and say, well, the actual value of this is somehow imprecise. And on an Everettian kind of picture, what you want to do is say the quantum state within a branch into branches in which quantities of interest are precise enough for all practical purposes. And in a collapse theory, what you want to do is have it collapse to something that's precise enough for all practical purposes. But okay, people might worry about whether that makes sense. Quantities that don't have definite values but have some kind of smeared outness to them. And we can have that discussion. Yeah. I don't think Tim would be happy with that. But notice, if we're having that kind of discussion about the viability of a quantum state momentism thing, it's not a worry about the relationship of the quantum state to space-time. You know, because we're associating these quantities with regions of space-time because, you know, theory we start with, you know, it starts with these field operators associated with points of space-time, and then the states are assignments of numbers to those. Okay, so let's just assume that we've sorted that out, that we've got some kind of ontology for our quantum theory that does indeed make sense of ordinary objects. Also includes the quantum state as something real. The attempts at interpretation quantum mechanics that I find myself able to take seriously, I'll include the quantum state as something real. We've heard about, you know, possible alternatives, including some kind of Humeanism. But for the purpose of this talk, I'm going to be taking it as something real. We've already said that quantum states have built-in relations to regions of space-time. In particular, it makes sense to talk about the state of a bounded region of space-time by saying, okay, the quantum state, what it was, that was an assignment to expectation values of operators all over space, well, I can just confine my by attention to those associated with this room in the time in between 2 o'clock and 3 o'clock. There's a bounded region of space-time. So I can talk about quantum states and bounded regions of space-time. And here's where the non-separability comes in. If I've got two regions of space-time, A and B, I assign values or expectation values to all the operators associated with this. I assign expectation values to all the operators associated with this. The set of operators associated with the union of those regions is going to include all of these, plus products and sums of them. And if I tell you how to assign a value to an operator A and an operator B, I haven't yet told you how to assign the value to the product of them, for example. So, it's just sort of built into the way we've defined quantum states is that take two regions, take the state of those, which is the restriction of the assignment of numbers to operators associated with that region. The composite region is going to have operators in it that aren't in either region because they're products of the two or sums of the two, and you need to say something about those, so the just the quantum state of those regions isn't going to tell you anything about it, isn't going to uniquely specify the quantum state of the combined region. Okay. All right. Ignore that. Okay. So, the take-home lesson is, there's one particularly simple quantum field theory, and simplest case, you're dealing with a non-interacting field, and you do the analysis, and you find the energy levels, the energy eigenstates, differ by discrete amounts. And those can be more or less vocalized and move around, and we've got something that kind of acts like particles. And when people do quantum field theory, it's also known as particle physics, that's really what they're talking about. Field quantum. And they do act somewhat like particles, though they have a certain smeared out relation. They have a certain smeared outness to them. They're not confined to points, and they're not conserved. They can be created and destroyed. And crucially, that description isn't available for interacting theories, but it can be a useful approximate description for effectively free fields. So, for example, if we've got, you know, some particles that we're scattering off of some, you know, colliding in a collider, and they do all kinds of high energy things and interact with each other, and then, you know, we let them go out and have detectors, you know, in the in and out regions, they can be treated as effectively real, so effectively free, and we can talk about detecting these field quanta or particles, and that's how the, you know, that's what you read in the reports that come out of CERN and things like that. They said, we had all these particle detectors, and this is what we detected. What they mean is, we've got an effectively free field far from the scattering region, and we can talk about these field quanta as if they're particles. On a quantum state monist ontology, then, you know, particles will be fundamental, but there'll be this a useful way of talking about certain states of the theory. You can add in particles. There are interesting complications. I'm not going to go into that, but there's nothing in this that says, no, you can't also have point particles that always have definite locations. Okay, keep going that. So a single particle state, that first one is a state that differs from the lowest energy state in a region centered at the point X, relatively small region, and single quantum or single particle states can be written as sums or integrals over those. With this, and this is where I want to. So if you look at this, okay, this is, you know, a disturbance at time t located at point A at X. I can also add those up, or since there's a continuum of them, the equivalent of adding them up is taking an integral, and then, you know, there's this function out here. That function that occurs in that representation of that very special kind of state is those single particle wave function. And it can be defined in terms of the state like that. And I just want to sort of point out what this is. This on the right, that's the global quantum state. It's a vector represented by a vector in Hilbert space. Nothing local about that. That's a field operator defined at a point. That's the lowest energy state, ground state. But the very definition of this quantity, this wave function, is not an implicit reference. It's an explicit reference to the entire global state. It doesn't even look like a global quantity. Similar for two particle states, we have a similar definition. And don't worry if you don't understand this. All the details. The point is, I've got this function, and what it is it's defined in terms of global quantum state, the ground state, the lowest energy state, and two occurrences of these field operators defined at points. So, and then if they, okay, this is a function of two points. That's kind of cool. And we can, if you want, then construct a configuration space out of the set of all those pairs of points. But that configuration space is constructed out of things defined at points on regular space-time. So there's no worry about this configuration space getting unstuck from ordinary space-time. And this representation of the state, in terms of a two-particle wave function, that's only available for certain special states, two-particle states. And in an interacting theory, that's never going to be an exact description. It's going to be, approximate description of the state in certain, in certain domains where we treat it as effectively for free. So that's what I was saying earlier. There's just no way configuration spaces can be fundamental. They're constructed from things defined on ordinary space-time. As a representation for a limited class of states, and it's only an approximate representation in many ways. Okay. In general, insofar as we can treat the field as a free field, a state will be a superposition of the lowest energy state, which we call the vacuum, plus a one particle state, plus a two particle state, in general. And, I already said that. Okay, I thought I had something on the next slide. And what happens if you take the square of the wave function there is, the one part, square of the one part of the wave function will give you, integrated all over overall space, will give you the magnitude of that one particle component. All right. I said that. Okay. So no worry the configuration space is more fundamental. No worry the configuration space will come unstuck from space-time. Okay. So here's where I cash in what I said earlier. Even for a single particle state, we shouldn't think of wave functions as fields. If fields mean, to be a field means assigning local fields to points in the space it's defined on. On the previous slide, you can sort of see where this is going. It's like, I pointed out in the very definition, it's the definition of that wave function is defined in terms of the global state. It's not an implicit reference, but an explicit reference to the global state. But here's one way of seeing it. Suppose I have a single particle state, and it's got a wave function. If it is a field, because I think that all the people who are talking about this, and David Albert is explicit about this, what he minds be a field is something that does assign intrinsic properties to points of space, then a state. A state that's just like the state we started with inside a region containing that point x should have the same single particle wave function. But take a single particle state and then take another state where there's another particle. It's a two-particle state and the second particle is confined to a finite region over here. That's a two-particle state. It's a state with no one particle component. It's a two particle state. But with one particle wave function zero. So we have two states. We got this point here. One with a first state has a finite value of a single particle wave up to that point. Second state is just like the first state in a region very far from that. In one case, there's a finite non-zero value of that single particle wave from that point. The other state, it's zero at that point. Single particle wave function, they're not local vehicles. Okay. All right. Now, when I say things like this to people like David Albert, they say, "Well, yeah. That's all true for quantum mechanics. But what I mean is, there's going to be some infinite dimensional space, not like a configuration space, and for quantum field theory, and I want to represent the quantum state as a assignment of local variables to this big infinite dimensional space. Can you do it? If you can, then he should do it. It would be a fairly drastic reformulation of our quantum theories. There are, there's going to be some technical difficulties associated with it. But what I want to say is that's not the ordinary way of formulating our quantum field theories. So the sort of theory, that would admit an interpretation that David was talking about, a state is assignment of local variables to some infinite dimensional space, that is not our familiar quantum theories. It's a hypothetical theory that's yet to be constructed. So, I hope you're getting the sense that any idea, any sense that the default interpretation of quantum mechanics is that what we really live in is a high dimensional space or infinite dimensional space, it's just false. That would be a possible interpretation of a hypothetical yet to be constructed theory. And actually, this is the stumbling block, I think. Could we formulate when we formulate our ordinary quantum field theories, we make heavy use of the space-time structure. I alluded to that earlier. I said, we're familiar with quantum field theories in Minkowski space-time. You can do it in curved space-time, but it's harder. That's because you lack certain symmetries in those curved space-times that you take advantage of in formulating your quantum field theory in Minkowski space-time. Can we formulate, what we always do is we start with some background space-time. But what Albert wants is, our familiar space-time to emerge as some consequence of the way things interact, which would mean that, he would have to formulate this hypothetical theory, the dynamics thing, that something that doesn't presuppose any relation to this space or a familiar fourth-dimensional space-time. And again, I have no proof that it can't be done. I do know that it hasn't been done. All right. Okay. Do I have a little bit of time left? Okay. Good. All right. Now I want to go back and catch in what I said earlier, that I was going to say that this way of thinking about wave functions sheds light on Einstein's arguments about quantum mechanics. I'm going all the way back to the 1927 Fulbright conference. And there's an argument it's in the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paper of 1935. It appears several other places in Einstein's writings, including perhaps the clearest presentation is a 1948 article published in the journal Dialectica. So assume separability. And the argument is that it's been used in different ways by different authors. Einstein's use of it was quantum states aren't a complete description of physical reality. You've got to do something more. It's also been used more, arguments like this have also been used more recently to the effect that quantum states shouldn't be thought of as representing anything real. So you assume separability, all variables supervene on local variables. You assume locality, local variables at one location cannot be instantaneously affected by actions on another location. Okay, so if I take the quantum system as something real in the world, it's a local property of the system, cannot be affected by operations on the other. But if I have a pair of entangled systems, say a pair of spin one half particles in a singlet state, on the usual way of talking about it, if I measure, say, spin z over here and get a result, say plus,
Then I attribute a spin z minus over there. And if I measure spin x and get, say, minus, then I attribute a state spin x plus to the other one. So depending on my choice of measurement, I'm going to attribute different states to that other system without having interacted with it. And the conclusion is that there's just no way that any one of those states is going to be a complete description of the physical states of affairs there. Some people have drawn the conclusion that these quantum states are actually just, states of knowledge. They're not physical. Okay. All right. Now, at the 1927 Solvay conference, which is, this is really like quantum theory is a real new theory. Everybody who's anybody in physics was there to talk about this new theory. They recorded the discussion. I guess there's a stenographer there. I don't think they had things like that. But there was someone taking shorthand. And it was published. And there was general discussion at the end, and this is one of the things that Einstein said. So if the square of the wave function were simply regarded as the probability that at a certain point a given particle is found at a given time, it could happen that the same elementary process produces an action in two or several places on the screen. But the interpretation according to which psi squared expresses the probability that this particle is found at a given point assumes an entirely peculiar mechanism of action at a distance which prevents the wave continuously distributing space from producing an action in two places on the screen. So the idea is that if you've got this wave function sort of spreading out, and you've got a screen made up of lots of particle detectors, and we know that, if you think of this wave as sort of a visible wave, there seems to be no mechanism to enforce it from affecting the screen in only one place, right, without some kind of action in the distance. But what we do find is that there's a single part of wave function that you get a detection at one and one only place. Now this looks very different from the later EPR style arguments in Einstein's versions of those which always involve two systems in an entangled state. There's only one particle here. I'm going to read this. In my opinion, one can remove this objection only in the following way, that one does not describe the process solely by the Schrödinger wave, but at the same time one localizes the particle during the propagation. So already he's saying the quantum wave function isn't everything. I think that Monsieur de Broglie is right to search in this direction. If one works solely with the Schrödinger waves, interpretation 2 of psi squared implies to my mind a contradiction with the postulate of relativity. So he thought that the de Broglie theory was on the right track. De Broglie and other people were kind of dissatisfied with the theory, in part because the wave function for more than one particle was a function on configuration space rather than physical space. But he thought it had the flavor of the right kind of thing. Alright. Now, there's another argument that he expressed in letters to de Broglie and other people.
It's basically the same thing.
Imagine you've got two boxes in Paris and Tokyo, so maybe you prepare a particle so its wave function is entirely one box, then you put a partition down the middle and you take two parts and you send one off to Tokyo. And so the state of the particle is a superposition of being in box one and box two. And if you open one box and see a particle there, if you're in Tokyo and open the box and see a particle there, you say you're sure that the person in Tokyo won. Now again, this sounds like a very different argument from the EPR argument because there's only one particle, there's no entanglement. Okay. All right. But put it this way, the theory that, think of this from the point of view of the theory that have been outlined in the quantum field theory don't have any fixed particle numbers, and what you count, the basic things would be how many particles there are in a certain region of space-time. So let N1 be the state in which there's N particles in box 1, N2 be a state in which there's N particles in box 2, and that's a state in which there's N in box 1 and M in box 2. So another way of writing that same single particle state that we had earlier is this. It's a superposition of a state in which there's one particle in box 1 and 0 in box 2, and a state in which there's zero particles in box 1 and one particle in box 2. And the single particle state, it's a state that makes it obvious that it is an entangled state. The state of affairs in box 1 is entangled with the state of affairs in box 2. And that's going to be always true of single particle states, or n particle states, or actually any state of bounded energy. It's going to have entanglement across spatially separated regions. So that makes it clear that it's an entangled state. And then, it becomes, analogous to the EBR argument phrase in terms of the familiar singlet state example. And there's nice discussions of seeing those boxes arguments in this way in an article by Travis Norrison and an article by John Norton. So if you're interested, you can take a look at those. Thanks for your attention.